you very much, Greg, for the introduction. And it's a great honor to actually present some of my work that I have done during my career. And this work is profoundly actually affected by Malcolm Sumner from the time that I've known him via the literature and then working for him as one of his graduate students. I really enjoyed my time there. It, without any doubt, was the best time of my life. And I really appreciated Malcolm, whatever, everything you've done for me. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work that I'm doing. First of all, my name is Nick Shafoku, and these are two of my collaborators right now at Pacific Northwest Nation Laboratory. Phil Young is the PI in a big project that we have to address problems that are related with the uranium contamination in one of the DOE contaminated sites. These are the areas that Greg actually presented in one of his slides where Malcolm has done, has contributed the most. And of course, these two areas that I have highlighted here are the ones that affected me the most, initially with the soil fertility and nutrient diagnosis, and then surface chemistry and soil and soil minerals. I tried hard, actually, to make a copy of my thesis that I wrote in 1989 when I was a professor or assistant professor at the University at Agricultural University of Tirana in Albania. And this is a thesis written in Albanian, so I suspect that nobody here can understand what is written here, even though the quality is not as good. I tried hard, though, to do my best there. Anyway, the chapter number 5 here, it's a study of the Dries indices that Malcolm actually contributed in the literature. I want to tell you a personal story about that. It was somewhere in 1986. I was working at that university back to Albania. Albania at that time was a country that was completely isolated from the world. We were not able to get literature from the coming from the Western countries. But anyway, somehow I got a coupon from the British Library to order some papers, and the papers that I ordered were from Malcolm Sumner. So I wanted to say that kind of fact here because this actually shows the global impact of Malcolm Sumner's work. He was able actually to penetrate in one of the most impenetrable countries with his work. And and I was really, really affected by his work. And in my thesis that I wrote at that time, I included tables. There are like 70 tables, like this one, where, and again, this is in Albanian, and where I included the Dries indices where I calculated following the methods developed, you know, by Malcolm and the co-workers. And I calculated all the degree of requirements of different elements, and this is the yield here. So another area that Malcolm actually asked me to work when I came here in the United States was the survey chemistry of soil minerals. And what I did at that time, actually Malcolm was able to bring to me in the lab a collection of 32 different soils collected from many areas around the world. And he assigned me the duty to study the movement of nitrate through these soils. And these were actually collected from, these were oxysols or alfisols or highly weathered soils, actually. And I was very excited to start on working with them. And this is a graph that I generated at the time showing the transport of, calcium nitrate through a sisal soil collected in southeastern United States in Georgia. And we were surprised to see that there was a simultaneous absorption of calcium nitrate measured in the effluent of a column that was packed with this soil. So we were trying to understand why this actually happened. And of course, other people before me studied that phenomenon. They called it salt adsorption. And then we realized that actually this happened regardless of the concentration of the input solution that we used, at, which again was calcium nitrate. Again, you see this plateau here of almost zero concentrations of calcium and nitrate. And we were trying to explain that phenomenon. And then we tried, we came up with a simple conceptual model. As you very well know, the mineralogy of variable charge soils or highly weather soils is dominated by kaolinite or some phyllosilicates like micas, for example, that can be present there, but mostly there are iron oxides. And we came up with this idea that, you know, the iron oxides are you know, absorb different anions, while the surfaces of the phyllosilicates in this case are saturated with different cations. And then what happens during intensive leaching, the diffuse layer that is around the iron oxides expands actually and overlaps over the diffuse layers that is on the surfaces of phyllosilicates. And this creates the possibility of these ions that are in those overlapping regions to actually interact together, form a salt, and then move out of that region. And probably this is one of the possible explanations for this phenomenon that people called it in the literature salt adsorption. It's very hard, though, to probe those interfaces here, even with today's techniques that we have. So basically, not much has been done since the time, you know, that we came up with this model to actually try to probe those interfaces. You can do stuff calculations nowadays, the computers that we have, and probably sometime in the future I'll try to do that. Of course, soils are pretty complicated systems, and many people, even outside our community of soil sciences, has realized that. Now soils are the final frontiers for many people working especially in the environmental areas. And what makes soils very complicated are, for example, in this case, we have a feldspar particle, but on top of it, we have a layer of iron oxides, for example, that actually changes the properties of that particle. In this other scanning electron micrograph that I am presenting here, it's a feldspar particle, which is completely covered with smectite. And of course, in this case, the surface property of original feldspar particle are completely changed by that covered smectite layer. When we do have minerals like trioctahedral chloride in this case, that are able to undergo kind of fast weathering, releasing the elements that are in its structure in this case. And in this case, I was interested in the release of iron 2, and iron 2 is a redox sensitive element that can be actually involved in redox sensitive in redox reactions that can occur in soils. There are other things that you know can happen in a soil. For example, I was working with some sediments from the Hanford site, which were exposed to very highly alkaline solutions. And what happened in this case, the sediment was exposed to those highly alkaline solution. Dissolution of the existing minerals occurred, and after that, precipitation of some newly phases occurred too. And then in this case, for example, I show another particle of feldspar, which is covered by these structures that were formed during the time that the sediment was exposed to the highly alkaline solution. And this is, in this case, is cancrinite. Now, one can imagine that the surface properties of this feldspar particle are drastically changed as a result of this coverage with cancrinite particles. I wanted to show you another example before I go to something else. And this is a particle of mica that, again, was exposed to highly alkaline solution. And this is the surface of the mica, and this is the edge of the mica. And many people know that this is a phyllosilicate. But in this case, the edge of that particle was completely destroyed by the base attack. And here we have the formation of a new mineral that was not even present at the beginning in this sample, which is sodalite. So again, I'm trying to make the case that, you know, as a result of weathering or different kind of phenomena that can happen in the soil, the surface properties can be, the surface properties of the minerals in soils can be changed drastically. So it always, it is required for us to do a careful characterization of the samples that we are dealing with. I want to switch gears now and going to some to a project that I'm working right now, that is a contaminated area in Rifle, Colorado, not far from Denver, and this happened to be a U.S. Department of Energy uranium vanadium ore processing facility, and as one can imagine, this area can be, it is actually contaminated, especially with uranium, and what we are trying to do right now is to understand first the way uranium interacts with the soil minerals that are there, and then try to find out strategies to actually immobilize uranium from the aquaspace. There are field-scale biostimulation experiments undergoing right now at the Rifle site, and the idea here is to inject acetate in the subsurface. Acetate can serve as a carbon source for the microbes that are present in the subsurface. And what can happen after that, there is a good chance that uranium actually that is present as uranium-6, oxidized uranium-6, can actually get reduced to uranium-4. And once this actual reaction happens, uranium-6 that is mobile can actually transform to uranium-4 that is not mobile in soil. So basically the idea here is to feed the microorganisms that are here. They can actually generate some electrons, and uranium can accept those electrons, transforming itself from uranium-6 to uranium-4 and actually becoming immobile. We actually received some sediments from that area, and the scientific objectives that we had at that time was to determine the identity and physical location of uranium sorbents, study the affinity of uranium for different soil minerals, determine uranium-6 and uranium-4 solid phase speciation, and study the effect of different geochemical variables on the extent and rate of uranium attenuation. I will be focusing today on the objective number 2 here, study the affinity of uranium for different soil minerals. The first thing we did with these sediments, actually, what we did we separated the different size fractions from this sediment. And we were very surprised to see that in one sediment, which is going to be the focus of my talk today, the content of uranium was very, very high as compared to the other sediments, and especially was high in the less than 53 micron fraction. We discovered later that the concentration of iron and sulfides were pretty high in that sample as well. So what we decided to do is to use some of the techniques that we have, like XRD, micro-XRD, XRF, and osmosis barrier spectroscopy, SEM and EDS, and SEM combined with FIB, TEM, electron microprobe, and laser spectroscopy, and other spectroscopical method, to figure out the way that uranium actually interacts with different solid phases that are present in this sediment. And again, I repeat that the concentration of sulfur and iron was higher in this particular sediment that has a high concentration of uranium. The Mosbauer actually spectroscopy showed us that there were iron sulfides present there, but in the group of iron oxides, there were magnetite present there as well. So basically the next step was to use the SEM, the scanning electron microscopy, to locate the magnetite particles and to try to study to study them in terms of the surface chemical properties. And we are lucky enough in the institution where I work at PNNL to have an instrument that allows us to actually go on the surface and literally dig the surface and even get samples from this surface, take the sample out, and then interrogate that sample with other more sensitive instrument other than the scanning electron microscopy, which is combined with EDS. And in this case, what we did, we took a sample of this magnetite surface and we brought it in the TEM, and then we tried to figure out whether this magnetite surface was a pure one and whether it was a polycrystalline magnetite or not. The next step, what we did, we actually conducted some electron microprobe studies to figure out whether the uranium was concentrated or not on the surface of that magnetite particle. And we were very surprised to see, well, surprised, we were happy to see that uranium was actually accumulated on the surface of that of magnetite. This actually is the mapping, the elemental mapping of uranium, and the reddish colors that go high concentration as compared to the green color. The other thing that we discovered in this particular sediment, and we were very excited about it, was the presence of some structures like balls, and they were very interesting because they were composed of different microcrystals, and they actually then we figure out later that these were microcrystals of pyrite, which actually likes to form some structures that are called rhomboids. And we were very excited to see that in this particular sample, there were different type of those rhomboidal pyrites that were present. They have different morphologies, that they have different microporosities, and it appears that they probably have different chemical composition. We were very excited about it, of course, because rhomboids are not very well studied in the literature. And they are. It's even unclear for the moment why pyrite actually forms this kind of structure, and there are many questions related to the origin of this. But I'm not going to go in this discussion right now. But what I want to tell you is that the surface of pyrite actually can be subjected to oxidation, and as a result of the oxidation, there are other mineral layers that can be formed on the top of that pyrite. And in this case, for example, this is a conceptual model taken from the literature. There are iron oxides that may be formed, or there are iron sulfides that may be formed on the top of the surface of the pyrite. Now, why is this important? This is important because, for once, pyrite can react directly with uranium, but even better, these other layers that are formed on top of the pyrite can actually react with uranium too. And our objective is to actually figure out what happens to uranium. What happens to uranium that is oxidized as uranium-6, whether actually it can absorb on the surfaces of the pyrite or whether it actually can undergo some redox reaction on these surfaces. Now, of course, we started first the surfaces of pyrite using scanning electron microscopy combined with EDS. And EDS allows us to figure out what is the chemical composition of those particles. And some of them, actually this one here, they had the ideal concentration of sulfur and iron that one can expect to see in a pyrite. In pyrite, 66% sulfur and 33% iron for the FeS2 formula. However, in this other rhomboidal pyrite that was present in the same sample, we saw that oxygen was present too, and the ratio between sulfide and iron was not 1:2. So basically, this was the first indication that this rhomboidal pyrite or the pyrite surfaces underwent some sort of weathering to form other minerals that might have been actually precipitated on the surface of these pyrites. And as a matter of fact, we actually try to study the surfaces of the pyrite microcrystals within the rhomboidal pyrite. And we were able to see that the rim, actually, that goes around this microcrystal surface has a different composition, is different from the bulk pyrite. But as of today, we were not able actually to figure out what the phase is there. Sure, we intend to do some additional work, and that is something that we are doing right now. The classical bulk reaction of aqueous uranium with pyrite is actually described here. And again, uranium actually as a uranyl plus six, I mean as uranium plus six, can be transformed to uranium four, and actually can be separated from the aqueous phase, forming a solid phase, which contains again uranium four. And these are some pictures of again the rhomboidal pyrite, showing some sort of growing on top of those rhomboidal pyrites. Again, indication that probably. This is an indication that probably these pyrite surfaces underwent some sort of weathering. But of course, the main question that we have was that is pyrite actually able to react with uranium to form uranium 6, and is pyrite able to sorb uranium, and what is the role of the internal porosity that those rhomboidal pyrites have in terms of the release of uranium into the aqueous phase. These are some data from the scanning electron microscopy combined with electron microprobe that shows that uranium actually is indeed accumulated on the surfaces of these rhomboidal pyrites. And we were very, very happy to see that. And we saw that in any kind of pyrite sample that we interrogated using this technique. And of course, what we did next was that we took a sample of our sediment and sent it to the Argonne National Laboratory to conduct there some XRF and XFs and Zanes measurements. And we were very happy to see that uranium was accumulated again on the surfaces of the pyrite. And we saw there that uranium existed as uranium 6 and uranium 4. So basically, this was the proof that uranium underwent reduction. And actually, we published that paper in November 2009 in ESNT, and it was very well received. Even made it to the DOE Pulse, actually. So we are very excited about that. There is one thing that we are studying right now, and Greg, if I have 1 minute, there is something that is very interesting, actually. There are some sort of biofilms that are accumulated on top of these pyrite surfaces, and as of now, we have no clue what they are and what their role is. So this is something that we are dealing right now. Conclusive remarks. Of course, natural organic carbon drives uranium, iron, and sulfur reduction in these particular sediments. Uranium actually exists as uranium 6 and uranium 4. We were not able to isolate other iron sulfides that other authors actually have said that probably are present in sediments under those conditions, iron reducing and sulfide reducing conditions. And of course, we are doing more work to understand a bunch of other problems that are related to the uranium adsorption and reduction on the surface of pyrite or other minerals that are present in these sediments. Thank you very much.